a good sign is that he's in this Wieserlich. But he was he goes and speaks out very strongly about how the American people were lied to consistently by the Bush administration, that actually lured into, that's his word, into accepting the unprovoked invasion of his sovereign nation. And the run-up to our invasion of Iraq featured the president and members of his cabinet invoking every frightening image they could come up with, from mushroom clouds to buried caches of germ warfare to drones, police to deliver germ-laden death in major cities. It was the exploitation of fear. And he talks about, you know, there hasn't been any immediate threat to the United States. They, he says, they didn't even lift an airplane against us. So he says, this situation raises enormous questions about, he calls it prevarication. That's another fancy word for lying. And the reckless use of power. How often have you seen that in the mainstream news talking about what Bush et al. Did? Where you can imagine Tom Brokaw or Peter Jennings, anyone standing up and talking about President Bush and using a reckless use of power. No, you just don't see it. The corporate media just lock, stock, and barrel with the right along backing up the government all the way. The government, the news media, the main corporate media, it's like I say, the corporations and the government are in the bed together. And the feather in one another's nest, so you're not going to get the truth from either one of them, more so all the time. He goes on, where our troops needlessly put at risk, were countless Iraqi civilians killed and maimed when war was really not necessary? Was the American public deliberately misled? Was the world? I mean, I think these are pretty pertinent questions. And he talks about how things are worse now in Iraq than they ever were, with the scarcity of necessities of life and so forth. He talks about the contracts that have been awarded to the American corporations to rebuild Iraq. He talks about how diplomacy has been replaced by force and by just unilateral decision-making and so forth. Well, he says the truth will emerge in the house of cards built of deceit will fall. Thank you. This has been Tom Clooney.
Okay, Tom, how'd it go?
Oh, just fine. Just fine. Glad to do my share.
Okay. Good night. Good evening, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our colleagues. Of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or in here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because, of course, we have with us on the line from South Africa. Of course, she's over here visiting at the present time. But his name is Charles Van Fake, and he is, of course, an he's Afrikaans. He's visiting here. He works with Peter Hammond in In Touch Ministries, and Peter Hammond was our guest last week. We're going to have a fascinating time going into really what's happening halfway around the world. But, of course, what happens in South Africa has a profound impact upon what's happening here in America, because the parallels between the two countries are really very, very striking. At the same time when our pioneers were journeying west in covered wagons from the East Coast, why the Afrikaners were journeying eastward across the veld in South Africa to escape from the British rule. And, of course, they're very, very similar as far as indigenous people there. The difference between, of course, the Americans and the South Africans is the Americans killed most of the Indians, and the South Africans tried to live with them and work with the South Africans. Yes, there's injustice in any society where there are different races, but I lived in South Africa, and I will tell you that most of what you've heard about apartheid just isn't true. And I felt a great deal of closeness and for the black as they felt for me. I was in Soweto at the time when Soweto was burning. I was in South Africa when Soweto was burning, and I was called to my hospital where I was the chief of orthopedics the night when Soweto was going up in flames. And it was the only time I ever really felt any fear in South Africa. There were no whites except in the operating room waiting for me, and thousands of blacks. And I had to walk down a hall where there were 1,500 blacks sleeping on the floor. And about 100 yards down that hall with literally no lights at all. And I suddenly sensed that they were far more frightened than I was. In fact, they looked to me as a sense of security. So I, being 6'5", pulled myself to my full height and strode down the hall. And I suddenly realized, of course, they were fearful. They didn't want the revolution there. They didn't want to lose their homes, their lives. They didn't want to be necklaced because they spoke out against what was happening. Well, with us, of course, is Charles, who lives in South Africa, and he has a number of fascinating stories to tell us, including the story of the massacre that occurred in Cape Town, where, of course, one man stopped the massacre as the people came in with their automatic weapons to mow down the whites who were there. Charles, thanks so much for coming to be with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, great being with you, and good day to the listeners, too.
Well, why don't we start with the story? What do they call that massacre in South Africa?
Yes, it was on the 25th of July, 1993, and it was called the St. James Massacre. And the reason for that is because the church that was attacked was called St. James. It was a denomination of, or is the Church of England in South Africa, which is not part of the higher church, which is very liberal. It's a conservative evangelical church.
All right, fine. And so, of course, what happened? How many people came in? How many weapons did they have?
Okay.
And what happened?
Well, that evening we were just busy sitting in church listening to some people that were worshipping the Lord singing to us on our stage. And the church is very much built like a cinema. In other words, higher at the back and then sloping towards the stage in the front. And while these young people were singing to us, there was a noise at the front door of the church where the stage was, where everybody could see. And straight away, you know, my thoughts were, you know, why are these people coming late and making such a noise? They should come around the back, you know. And all of a sudden, we had these four terrorists that came into the church. Three of them could be seen coming in there. They lobbed hand grenades into the congregation, which they had attached nails to get more force and impact. And they had automatic assault rifles with them, and they just started shooting into the congregation. And that evening, they murdered 11 people and injured 54.
All right, fine. Well, then what happened? What part did you play?
Okay, what happened was that when they started shooting, I immediately went down with everybody else. We all just hit the ground, try to get as low as possible. And I then pulled out a .38 special revolver that I carried with me, and I returned fire at them. I shot two shots in the church at them, and then I ran out of the back door to get them as they were getting to their car, and I shot another three shots at them. And one of my rounds hit one of the terrorists, and they managed to, through forensics, trace his blood in the getaway car, and they managed to match the chap and catch him. So that's basically what happened that evening.
Well, now, of course, you really stopped it from being a lot worse because you had a weapon, and as soon as you started shooting, they ran for cover, didn't they?
Yes, that's right. Even at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was set up in South Africa to bring reconciliation amongst the races, actually caused more trouble than it was worth. But at that meeting, they actually said they'd been shot at, and that's why they ran out of the church and left it. So the police also, with all the research that they did and interviews with people, also said that, it was due to the fact that they'd been shot at, that they ran away, and they expected far more people to have been murdered otherwise.
All right, fine. So basically then, of course, you were able to wound one of the people, and he was arrested and put in jail?
That's right. I ended up in the Supreme Court testifying against this young man. And after the court case was finished, I went and saw him in jail when he had been incarcerated, and I went and gave him the gospel. And it was pretty interesting because with regards to his theology that he'd been hearing, it was what we call liberation theology in South Africa. One of the proponents of that is Bishop Desmond Tutu, that many of the listeners have probably heard of.
Oh, yes, this Christian statesman who's always lauded and applauded by the church here, and yet he's a Marxist terrorist.
That's right. And so anyway, it's pretty interesting that he believed, this young man, that he was going to heaven because he had been fighting for a just cause, which is exactly what liberation theology teaches you. So I had the opportunity to give him the true gospel of Jesus Christ and our salvation by the grace of God through faith and not through murdering people and fighting for just causes and, the whole communist socialist ideology. And so I had that opportunity. And through that, I also met his commander, and his name is Letlapa Mpahlele. And he and I spent quite a lot of time together discussing worldviews, and the more I was giving him the gospel, the more he was telling me about his fighting for the just cause. And we built up an acquaintance together. And I think it's more an idea of, we get on very well because of the fact that we're enemies and we respect each other. And he then invited me to, much later, many years after we had met, he invited me to what they called a homecoming celebration that took place at his home, which is about 1,000 miles away from where I live. And he wanted me to come to the celebration. And what it was for was that the Bloemfontein justice system of the Free State had withdrawn all charges against him for the terrorism that he had been involved with in South Africa.
Now, was that because of the this program that you talked about earlier with
the PRC,
right?
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Now, funnily enough, he did hand in an application to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and their standard was that you had to do application to them for to be able to get off, or so that you wouldn't be jailed or held accountable for what you'd done, any terrorism during the time of apartheid. And he had handed in his application. Then he said, no, this is just a lot of nonsense. He's not interested anymore, and he withdrew his application from them. So he actually needed to go through the normal justice system. He didn't. He wasn't let off by the TRC. So it was very strange then, obviously, that the judges in the justice system, overrode the TRC, and they overrode the laws in our country and just let him off scot-free, which is a very, very interesting move they made, but it was obviously a political move.
All right, fine. So you then were asked to come to this meeting in the tribal area. Now, what tribal area was that?
It was right up in the north. He is part of the Sesotho people, northern Sesotho people. And they are right up at the top north of South Africa in a province called the Limpopo Province, which used to be called our Northern Transvaal, which you'd remember
after
having been there. And it was at an area called Louis Trichardt, which is the name has also changed now. But it was they live in a small little village in the middle of nowhere. I had to fly to Johannesburg, first of all, and then a friend picked me up, and we drove about 400 kilometers, about 300 miles into this area, taking dirt roads and things, I'll tell you, it was pretty scary going into this area with all these people that have been you know, radical Marxist type people and people that have been fighting, you know, in the military side of terrorism, basically, in South Africa. It was a very difficult decision to make whether I should go to this or not, because, you know, one has to understand that, you know, the civil magistrate has been set there by God to punish the wicked. And this whole idea of God, the God-ordained responsibility, was being usurped. And and that's exactly why the celebration was taking place, was because he had got off scot-free from all these cases that were against him for the murder. He had commanded his cadres to attack our church. They had attacked a pub. They had attacked another restaurant. All these places where many, many lives were lost. So, you know, my idea was that if I went there, I'd be basically saying that I'm quite happy with the fact that the government has withdrawn their charges, or the judicial system. And then I, you know, after thinking through this and praying through it, I realized, well, I'm not a minister of justice. I'm actually part of the Minister of Grace. I'm a member of the church. And in my personal capacity and as a member of the church, I need to get the gospel through to these people. And that's actually why I attended in the end.
No, I admire you for going, and I'm sure it was a terrifying experience. So anyway, of course, you get into this area, and I've been into these were the old Bantustans, I assume, the areas that were set aside under the apartheid system. So really, it's entirely black, isn't it?
Yes.
They're black tribal areas, really.
It was a black tribal area, and the only white people there were and those of us who had obviously been invited to the meeting, and there were some reporters. So there's one other lady and myself, and then obviously, you know, the people that brought us in, or reporters and what have you. And when I arrived there, you know, the people were already toying outside of his house. Now, I don't know if people understand that here, but it's when the people are dancing and starting to work themselves up, and often they get into quite a frenzy. At times, people have actually been killed, and cars been overthrown and burnt out and things when people start doing this, because they get into such a frenzy. But anyway, I arrived there, and you know, the people already toying outside his home. So it was a pretty frightening experience to arrive there. And it was a great opportunity. As I left my office, Dr. Peter Hammond read Psalm 27, and there he read, "The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? An army may encamp against me. My heart shall not fear." And there we went off to this meeting. And I was introduced to the queen of the Bakhlele people, which is the group that Wetlapa belongs to, his tribe and his family line. And it was pretty interesting meeting with her. And then eventually we got into this meeting where there were all these cadres and people that had been fighting in the revolution. And they would be standing up and the crowd would be cheering for them. And everything. And I'd be looking at this thinking, oh no, what have I done? Why have I come here? And but I realized, you know, there are not many people in South Africa that, you know, God has given this opportunity to be able to get the gospel to terrorists. So the master of ceremonies at this specific meeting was also the local tribal chief, and there were 22 speakers. Now, you know, I'm not big time into politics as it is, but to sit and listen to 22 speakers talking politics is quite hectic. But he then allocated only 3 minutes to each speaker. And I thought, oh, well, there we go. I'm going to have to change my whole talk. And then when I got up, he said, well, Charles van Beek will be speaking for 15 minutes. after he introduced me, I was like, wow, what an opportunity. And he introduced me as a survivor of the APLA attack, being the APLA, Azanian People's Liberation Army, which is the group that attacked our church. And I thought this was pretty funny because he just, you know, said I was a survivor of it. And I said to my friend that had come with me, you know, it's strange that they didn't say that I'm the chap that shot back. So he said, well, you know, how could they announce in this hall that you're the chap that shot at all their chaps with, you know, one of you with a .38 special revolver shooting, you know, three guys or four guys with AK with assault rifles and they ran away, you know. But anyway, when I started speaking to them, I spoke to them about the world's greatest revolutionary. And I mentioned to them that he was a second-class citizen living in an oppressed nation. It was a time of violence and hatred, and he lived a life of love. And that this revolutionary was arrested, he was beaten, he was whipped, he was spat at, thorns were shoved into his head, and nails were driven through his hands and feet. A sword was also taken and thrust into his side. And as I mentioned these things to them, you know, this, they could relate to this. You know, they've just come through a revolution themselves, and they were, you know, just sort of sighing and totally taken up with the pain and agony that this revolutionary had gone through for his just cause. And then I said to them that the message of this revolutionary was so radical that the authorities were so threatened by him that they even posted guards to guard his corpse after he died. And I carried on that the grave was later found empty, which is pretty interesting, and they found that he had actually risen from the dead. And the revolution grew after his death, even though vicious persecution of his followers took place. The empire tried to destroy his teachings. His followers were stoned, they were burnt, they were eaten by wild animals in stadiums. And while the crowds cheered on, his followers were being tortured and massacred, and every time they would return good for evil and love for hate, and they lived lives of joy and faith. And one of the interesting things was that the blood of the martyrs appeared to be the seed for the continuation of this revolution. And it said that for everyone that died in the arena, 10 stood up in the stadium to replace them. And these people were sitting dead quietly listening to all this because, as I've already said, you know, they could relate to this idea of a revolutionary. And then I said to them that the empire was defeated from within and taken over by these peace-loving people. And I ended with quoting to them a revolutionary life with a revolutionary message. Jesus Christ has continued to make a revolutionary impact on millions of people all over the world. And I call on you to join me in this revolution. And then I pulled out a Bible, and I said to them, I have a historical document here in the Northern Sesotho language, which covers and talks about the life of this revolutionary. And I handed this Bible to Letlapa, their commander, and in it I had asked him to join me to follow the world's greatest revolutionary, Jesus Christ. And it was very well accepted. It was pretty interesting that these people, you know, they've been taught Marxist theology and liberation theology and things like that, and they don't really understand the salvation by the grace of God through faith. And this was the opportunity to get the truth through to them.
You know, of course, the only solution is, of course, Christianity and changing the hearts of men.
That's right.
They're not going to, of course, accomplish that with armed revolution. And, of course, most of the people are not clever enough to understand they're being manipulated, as we see now in Rhodesia, the people who, of course, gave their lives fighting for the revolution in Rhodesia, of course. When it comes to distribution of farms, they're going, of course, to ministers of Mugabe, who is the Marxist dictator there.
Yes.
And, of course, the people are not getting anything at all. Before, they had jobs. They had an opportunity to get ahead. They had an opportunity for education. They had an opportunity to improve themselves. In fact, the living standards for the black in Rhodesia were extremely high. And now, of course, it's a total chaotic situation.
That's right.
And the same thing is going to happen in South Africa unless this foolishness ends. Unless, of course, you're able, of course, to reach the people. We're going to be back here in just a moment or two with Charlatan. They can, of course, we'll welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Charles Van Dyke, and he works with Peter Hammond in In Touch Ministry. And now you've actually written a book, haven't you?
That's right. I've actually written a book called Shooting Back, The Right and Duty of Self-Defense. You can just imagine, liberals in South Africa were just, totally unimpressed with the idea that I actually had a firearm in church and managed to shoot back at the terrorists. In fact, I was quite intrigued by Archbishop Desmond Tutu make comments in the newspaper about, how dare we use the evil weapons of, the same weapons as these evil people. But I took that as a bit of a compliment from him. But anyway, that was the whole story there. So I've written a book called Shooting Back, looking at the issues that I had to deal with through the massacre, the theological aspects of, do I need to love these people? Do I need to accept them? Do I need to forgive them? All these sorts of things that I've struggled through. And then I also just give a a brief overview of the attack in South Africa on us with regards to our freedom and the government wanting to take away our firearms. Africa is notorious for leaders taking away firearms from people and then massacring them after that a few years later. So this book is to encourage South Africans, well, first of all, to get the gospel through to firearm owners and then to encourage them to keep their firearms and not to allow them to be taken away.
No, it's very strange. They want to do exactly the same thing here in the United States. And, of course, they only want to take them away from the common people. The senators who are voting for these, people like Dianne Feinstein here in California, wants a gun for herself, but, of course, not for the
not
common
for other
folks.
People.
And this, of course, tyrants are the same all throughout the world.
That's
and
right.
We have an awful lot of tyrants in Washington, D.C., who do have a different agenda and talk about, of course, their compassion and concern and the danger of guns, and yet, of course, in your instance, you probably saved dozens of lives because you did have a firearm, and that's why I believe every person in America, every law-abiding citizen should have a right to carry and utilize a firearm in their own defense. So, basically, were you able to touch this man, this revolutionary, the one that you shot? Do you think this had an impact on his life?
Yes, I had the opportunity to explain the gospel to him and things, but I think there's been a greater impact on the life of his commander. And the reason I say that is, after I'd spoken at this meeting in the northern areas of our country, he then phoned me a few days later and invited me to speak at another meeting in Khayelitsha near Cape Town. And I mean, I was shocked. I didn't think, you know, I didn't think anything would ever come of this, you know. I mean, here I come as a Christian amongst these revolutionaries, telling them that they need to, you know, repent and they need to follow Jesus Christ. And anyway, he invited me to another meeting, and at the second meeting, I also spoke about Jesus Christ as the world's greatest revolutionary, but I also spoke beyond about 2 Corinthians 5 and dealing with the true reconciliation between man and God. So that was a great opportunity, and when he spoke at this meeting, or before this, every time I'd ever dealt with him, if I'd seen articles about him in the press, or I dealt with him, we were on television together and all this sort of thing, and his radio interviews, he always would explain and back up his idea for fighting for this just cause that he was fighting for. Very much Marxist thinking.
I'm going to have to interrupt you here because we're going to have to pull one of our stations from up north back in with us.
Sure.
In just a moment, so we'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Charles Van Dyke. And we're talking, of course, about his relationship with these Marxist revolutionaries. And, of course, they have been enschooled in a false philosophy. This idea, of course, that Marxism and communism is going to bring, of course, freedom to the underdog, without realizing, of course, that the whole scenario has been financed by the very people that they oppose. One of the hardest things for me to understand and to accept here in the United States was that one of the major financiers of socialism and communism in the United States were actually, of course, the Rockefeller and Ford and Carnegie Foundations and people of great wealth. And I think that's very hard for most people who, of course, accept this philosophy to accept. But you see, once you repudiate God and his rules, then, as someone once said, when you cease to believe in God, it's not that you believe in nothing, it's that you believe in anything. I think G.K. Chesterton said that, but I think it's really very, very true. And, of course, one of the great tragedies of this today is that all throughout the world they're preaching this revolution, Marxist revolution, liberation theology, and, of course, organizing these young people to go out and give their lives for absolutely nothing, because the end result of this whole world revolutionary movement is going to be a one-world dictatorship under a ruling elite. That's what happened in Russia. There is no communism in Russia. You had an elite rule, you had a massive police state, and everybody else subjugated, and anybody got out of line was tortured and killed. And, of course, this indeed is what's happening in Rhodesia today, a total chaotic situation there now. And, of course, what was once a very prosperous nation is now in chaos. The value of the property both of black and white has been destroyed. The blacks who used to have jobs now are starving, and they're really facing massive starvation in Zimbabwe. We call it Zimbabwe today. And, of course, it's being mediated by, of course, the idealistic Mugabe, the Marxist dictator that was brought to power by the American government. And if anybody doubts that he was brought to power by the American government, you need to study the history of that revolution. And, of course, this is the same thing we've done in South Africa and in Southwest Africa and Angola. And you might ask yourself why the American government is bringing communist governments to power throughout the world. But then why are we still finding one justification after another to send massive amounts of hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars to Russia? And, of course, why are we constantly financing communist China? In fact, this massive dam, the biggest dam in the world, the Three Gorges Dam, largely financed with money from the American taxpayer through the IMF and the World Bank. What's wrong with this picture? Why, of course, most of what people believe has nothing to do with reality. So why don't you pick up this story? You know, of course, then you were asked to give a second talk to the leader of this revolutionary group.
Yes, so I was speaking to them at the second meeting about Jesus Christ and us being reconciled between man and God before being reconciled between man and man, because that's what the meeting was about, reconciliation in South Africa. And it was pretty interesting at this time, Letlatha Mbeklele, the commander who gave go-ahead for the attack on our church, he, for the first time after all the other occasions, always backing up what he had done, actually asked for forgiveness and said that what he had done was wrong. And he had written a poem to a young girl that had been murdered because of his commands, and her mother was also at the meeting. And I just want to read the stanza, one of the stanzas in this. And he's an atheist. He's a Marxist revolutionary and an atheist. And in it he says, "Forgive us our idiocy, our souls attuned to heed prophecy by the graveside of the prophet whose blood we spilt, whose teachings we ridiculed while he walked among us," speaking about Jesus Christ. And I really think that the Holy Spirit is working in the heart of this man, and I pray that he comes to repentance one day. But it's just unbelievable the way the minds of these people have been so manipulated. He was trained in Russia and in Tanzania and things, so he's a full-blast Marxist. But it's just really interesting you mentioned about the communists and you know, them taking over the countries. I mean, the whole idea of communism is that government is supposed to be done away with at some stage. But these guys, once they get power hungry and they start, you know, eating away with the money and taking over the farms, there's just no end to it, you know. they don't seem to, you know, at what stage are they going to do away with the so-called government and have everybody equal? It doesn't seem like it's ever happened in history and probably never will.
No, it never will. It was never intended to. But, of course, how are you going to get people to give the whole of their lives in a revolutionary struggle if they really realized, of course, it was not true, it was not a... not as it say it was. In fact, Louis Bedens was the editor of the People's World, a communist newspaper in this country, and he told this story one day when one of the lead communists in America came around, and he was talking to him, and Louis Bedens said to this leading communist, "This system you're advocating will never work." And the man put his arm around him and said, "Louis, you're very, very smart. You're going to go a long way." Because they understood exactly what was going on. We'll be right back here in just a moment with our special guest. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Charles Van Dyck, and of course he's were you born in Cape Town, or you're born in the Orange Free State, or?
Yeah, I was born in Cape Town. I'm a native African. I was born, yes, on the southern tip of Africa in Cape Town.
All right, fine. Well, of course, your accent is so familiar to me, having lived and taught there in the University of Orange Free State in Bloemfontein, because it was really an amazing country, and it would have worked out its racial problems. They were doing everything they could. But, of course, you have to understand our government didn't want to do away with the racial problems. It wanted to preserve them. And, of course, this is what we did in Rhodesia. We brought the communist dictator to power. And now tell us what's happening up there in Rhodesia at the present time. I'm sure you're well acquainted with that. That is certainly one of the greatest human tragedies. People are facing starvation. And, of course, we did that. Of course, Henry Kissinger promised if there were any problems, we would come and settle them. But Henry Kissinger's promises and a dollar will get you a cup of coffee in some restaurants today. Not in most of them, however. Go ahead.
Yes, what's happening up there right now is that the Marxist dictator, Robert Mugabe, is running the country. He's the chap that was put into power for the help from the Western world. And he, interestingly enough, is now busy working to take away the farms from the farmers with this whole idea of Marxism where, you know, the lower classes need to take away from the bourgeoisie, the higher classes. But what's happening is when he's taking away the farms, many of these farms are going to his cabinet ministers. Now, these are not people that are at the bottom of the food chain. They have got millions. In fact, Robert Mugabe is said to be worth the amount that the same as the amount of the debt of his country, which is pretty interesting. And he's running the country down into the ground right now. Just to give you a simple illustration of one of the stupid things he did was he controlled the price of bread. Now, all you do when you're obviously controlling the price of it is, you know, nobody's going to produce any more bread because they can't make a profit on it. So now everybody's starving. There's no more bread in the country. Because he stopped, he made a ceiling price that bread wasn't allowed to cost more than a certain price. And obviously, all the ingredients for the bread and everything else is going up, but you can't charge more for the bread. So now people are starving and they don't have any bread.
Well, my understanding is the inflation over there is rampant, and the value of the currency, the savings of both the black and the white, has just been totally decimated.
That's right. The inflation rate at the moment is about 270% per year, and one person apparently, if I remember correctly, sold his house about 20 years ago, and he didn't. He just invested the money in the bank, and this money is so eroded that I don't think he can even buy a bicycle today with this money that he had banked, you know, instead of buying property or something with it. So your money, their savings, everything has just been totally eroded in the country. The shops are empty. Frontline Fellowship, which is the mission organization that I work with Dr. Peter Hammond, we've now been smuggling goods into the country because to help the poor and the suffering church there. Because if the government has anything that they know of that's coming in, they confiscate it for themselves and then hand it out to their own supporters, which is pretty normal in Africa. You know, every time the American government gives something to some dictators to help the people on the ground, it never ever gets there.
Now, and of course, my understanding is that Mugabe is using the shortages of food to kill off the blacks who oppose him.
That's right. And there's 7 million people that are busy starving to death in that country right now.
Seven million people are starving to death. Gee, and of course, all we're doing is hearing about the SARS epidemic over there in China that's killed, maybe 700 or 800 people.
Yes.
But you see, really what's happening here in America, and I just comment for our listeners, you have to understand that the media is controlling your reality. Mm-hmm. And they're focusing your attention on some things and ignoring the really important things, especially since, of course, America's prestige and honor and integrity were based upon the fact that if anything like this happened in Rhodesia, we would come to their aid. We promised them. We gave our sacred honor. But, of course, that tragically doesn't mean very much today. And people are beginning to understand that. And, of course, the tragedy is the American people don't seem to be concerned. And yet men and women are accomplices of the evils they fail to oppose, especially when, of course, their government had pledged their integrity to maintain the stability in Rhodesia. And that was the only reason that the whites there ceded power. Now, actually, they had a fairly democratic society there. My understanding is blacks could vote. And, of course, there was no apartheid. There was no separation of facilities at all in Rhodesia. They'd done away with the racial barriers, hadn't they?
That's right. Zimbabwe, or Rhodesia, before it became Zimbabwe, was probably the most peaceful country in the whole of Africa. Everybody had the vote for many years already. I mean, there was no such thing as apartheid like we had in South Africa. And then great system, great relationships between people. It was just a fantastic country, and Robert Mugabe came along. He murdered about 30,000 people in the east of his country, Matabele people.
Now, this is the man we brought to power.
That's right.
He was a murderer, and we put him in power.
This is the guy. He was already involved in terrorist activities, and they had already actually previously, before he came to power, had voting in the country for everybody, and another black president was brought to power, but he wasn't the Marcus revolutionary.
Yeah, that was Bishop Mezorewa, wasn't it?
That's right. Bishop Mezorewa. And what happened was that the Western world wouldn't recognize him, and they basically said, you'll vote again until this Marxist Robert Mugabe comes to power, which obviously, you know, stopped the war, because, you know, now the terrorist is now sitting in the so-called White House. And if people want to read some more, a little bit about what is going on in Zimbabwe, then they're welcome to have a look at our website.
Oh, tell us how to get there.
Yes, let me say that it's www.frontline.org.za. It's frontline.org.za or ZA. And there's some interesting articles there, also just looking at the ideas of what's been happening to the wildlife in Zimbabwe, and the way people have been treating animals on the farms that they've taken over, just slashing the calves of the animals that they can't walk anymore, and animals bleeding to death, and it's just unbelievable, setting traps. They're just wiping out the wildlife of the country.
And they used to have some of the most beautiful reserves there in Rhodesia or anywhere in the world.
It's been absolutely beautiful. I mean, they had the most fantastic wildlife. They also had great farms for hunters. They really were doing exceptionally well until this Robert Mugabe's come to power, and he's just wrecked everything. And he's had these young thugs that were so-called war veterans, but most of them are, you know, were born about 5 to 10 years after the war had already finished. And there was peace in the country. And he's using these young thugs and arming them to run around and to control the population. And typically, he has already disarmed the righteous people in the country. So they are now at the beck and call of these young thugs that are running around with AK-47s that they've been armed with.
Now,
pretty scary.
My understanding is that he was, of course, used up all of foreign capital that he had, financing, sending his army over to the Congo to fight there to keep the communists in power. Wasn't that true?
That's right. He, interestingly enough, as far as we could gather, is he was actually sending the people over there for his own interests with regards to diamond smuggling.
I see.
And it appeared that he was actually making a lot of money out of his defense force going over to help to help with the war in the DRC.
Well, now, he wasn't going to try to oppose De Beers' diamond cartel, was he? Stumbling by smuggling diamonds? That can get you into real trouble.
Yeah, that's right. Well, anyway, De Beers doesn't have too much control of what was going on in the DRC. I mean, there's some absolute chaos there. But the scary thing there, too, is that his army, obviously the chaps had been, you know, fighting in this war and the civil war inside the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and many of them have come back to Zimbabwe now. Now, these people aren't getting their pay, and they get upset, and they've got firearms, and, you know, the man with a firearm in Africa is king. So, you know, they would, these army and police chaps in Zimbabwe, if there are stores that have got food in it, which is, you know, not the normal thing. So if there is food in a store, apparently they would walk straight to the front of the queue where people have been queuing for days for food, chase the people away, walk into the shop, buy the goods at the normal retail price, and then take it into the black townships and sell it at, you know, 400% to 1,000% more than what they bought it for, making lots of money for themselves. So it's just absolutely frightening. A friend of mine was in a store where they had got some milk in, and he said people were standing just looking at the milk and pointing at it as if they hadn't seen this for years. And all they could do was look at it because they couldn't afford it. And this is the sort of thing that happens in a country when you start working out the, you know, the ideals of Marxism.
My understanding is that people go out and buy 4 or 5 television sets just so they'd have something to barter, because they knew their money would soon be worthless.
That's right. Yes, that's right. And I know of one couple also who apparently, you know, with the year 2 Y2K bug that they were concerned of, they'd stocked up quite a bit of food and everything, not knowing that their whole economy was going to go down the drain in the next year, and that the supplies that they kept was just worth, you know, thousands of Zimbabwean dollars, and managed to see them through this period.
Well, of course, but most of the people do not have those supplies, and everybody, you're talking right about almost half of the population. How many people are there in Zimbabwe today?
I think they're around, just trying to think now, they're much smaller than our country. There's probably about 25 to 30 million people.
All right, let's just see who I have on the line. Who is calling in?
Hi, Dr. Stan. This is Bill in Coeur d'Alene.
Okay, Bill, did you have a question or comment?
Yes, I was wondering if your guest could comment on the policy that Mugabe had with the farmers, especially be they black or white.
All right, were you talking now about seizing the land or what?
Yeah, seizing the land and what the farmers had to do, I guess, was basically leave.
Okay, fine. Well, why don't we talk a little bit about the seizing of the land? Because we know that he gave one nice farm to his sister and a lot of them to his...
That's right.
But they just came in and simply took the land, didn't offer to pay for it anything, did they?
That's right. There was talk previously a few years ago about them paying for the land and, you know, working through the issue of the government buying the land from them. And I mean, there might have even been one or two cases of that actually happening. But then they passed a law through government that they could just seize the land with no, you know, they didn't have to pay for it at all. And from there, it just went from bad to worse. They eventually would just arrive with a letter to the farmer saying that they're taking over all these various farms, and they would send him a personal letter saying you got basically 24 to 48 hours to get off the land. And he, plus all his labor, would have to, you know, get off the land as soon as possible, otherwise they'd be killed. And I'm sure you people heard in the press here of farmers who didn't get off the land. They got their families off the land, and they stayed behind and fought for their land and were murdered by these thugs. And this is the kind of thing that was going on. So the government didn't go through this in a very sort of specialized way where they try to work together with people and try to understand each other or try to compensate the farmer. That was all just political rhetoric. I mean, at the bottom line, at the end of the day, is they walked in there and took over the farms.
But, of course, the thing is that they're not producing now. These farms are not producing.
Well,
there's no
yeah.
food. One day, Rhodesia was one of the greatest food exporters in South Africa. And today, it's just total chaos.
Yes, and now they're obviously blaming it on the drought, you know. There's no food because of drought. Well, That's not the issue. I mean, there has been rain in Zimbabwe. The problem is that the thugs that have taken over the farms can't produce anything. You know, and you know, even the banks haven't been paid back for the farmers that have taken loans on capital to buy machinery and things like that. They've been left out of it too. You know, the government's not compensating them for the loans that are not being repaid. And you've got a bunch of people that are living on the farms that haven't got a clue of what's going on. They're eating whatever they can find and drinking whatever they can find, and they're not producing anything for the future.
Well, of course, when they drive the whites off the farms, they drive the black families off the farms as well, don't they? I mean, certainly
right.
There might be, you know, 50 or 100 black families that had lived there for many years.
That's right. That's right. I mean, some farmers had quite a lot of land, and they had various black families that had probably been with them, you know, 20 to 40 years, even longer. And they were driven off the land with the farmer. And so these people are all now becoming squatters. They don't have food to eat. And, you know, the government thugs are going around with their firearms and controlling the population and stealing food from them. And, you know, if you even just wear a T-shirt of the opposition party, I mean, you can get beaten to, you know, almost to death in that country.
Well, of course, the whites can't get out of the country because they can't get any money out, but neither can the blacks.
That's right. The whites can't... you know, their capital has just disappeared from under their noses. They got absolutely nothing. And the black people have got no money either now. So, you know, the only people that are sitting with money and farms and things are the government officials of Robert Mugabe.
Now, this is communism in action. This is the other face of communism that they never talk about.
Yeah, well, that's the interesting thing. You know, when I come over to the West here, I hear about, you know, these university professors that are talking about communism and socialism and how great it is. Well, you know, it's fine to talk about that if you're sitting in an air-conditioned room in the Western world. You know, it's great to theorize about these things, but, you know, we live under these conditions in Africa, and it's not very pleasant.
Okay, fine. Is there anything else you wanted to ask?
Real quickly, is it true that most of these farms are lost were farms that had been in existence for generations?
You got the question, Charles?
Yes, yes and no. Apparently, I think as far as I remember, there were over 80% of the farms have been purchased in the last, let's say, 40 to 50 years in Zimbabwe. So there weren't all of them that were been passed from generation to generation, you know, down the family line. Because the argument there, too, from the socialists was that the land had been stolen originally. And they seem to ignore the history where Cecil John Rhodes and these groups actually purchased land from chiefs, you know, tribal chiefs. They seem to ignore that at all. So there's a bit of a mixture of those who purchased in the last, you know, 40 to 50 years and those who, where they've had it passed down in generations.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much. And let's go to Neil calling from Kennewick. Hi, Neil, are you there?
Hi, Dr. Stan.
Right. Have a question or comment.
Yes, I'd like to, I really respected Ian Smith.
Did you want to speak up just a little louder?
Oh, I really respected Ian Smith when he was...
Right, and you want to know what happened to Ian Smith?
What happened to him, and did he change, or...
All right, well, that's
still a good man.
Well, yes. What's your thought on that?
Yes, I also have a great respect for Ian Smith. I mean, he had trouble from, you know, America, the whole of Britain... Everybody against him, and he was a really, I could say, maybe the only noble politician that I've ever come across in Africa. And we actually interviewed him on a radio show that we have in South Africa too. And strangely enough, this man is so principled that he is still living in Zimbabwe on his farm. And praise the Lord, they haven't touched his land yet. And the reason he's living there, when people ask him, you know, what on earth are you still doing in this place? He said, I'm one of the only reasons in this country that these people aren't going even more wild than they are. And he sees himself there as a representative of the peace-loving people, because television crews still arrive to interview him and that in the country. And he is basically, you know, I could say almost the only person in the country that has this... open direct contact with the rest of the world, where, you know, people would come and interview and listen to him, and he can actually tell the truth to them about what's going on. But really a noble character, a man that, you know, if he said something, you could believe him. He wasn't manipulative, he wouldn't be lying. In fact, I think he came off second best for trusting South African politicians who tried to manipulate him and mess him around.
No, that was John Forster who put the pressure on him, because, of course, Kissinger was putting pressure on Forster, and of course the trouble is, it's like feeding your friends the alligator, hoping he's going to eat you last.
That's
and
right.
The South Africans fed Rhodesia to the alligator, and then of course the alligator came after them.
That's right. He even explains in his book The Great Betrayal, which I'd really recommend to your listeners, written by Ian Smith, The Great Betrayal. He's writes in detail there about, you know, the history of Zimbabwe and when he was still in power and what was going on in the country. And it's pretty interesting stuff there. He talks about his meetings with Forster, and at that time, P.W. Botha was the Minister of Defense. And he talks very highly of Mr. Botha, who later became President in South Africa. And he hasn't got many nice things to say about Mr. Forster and our Foreign Minister, Pak Botha, at the time. And he said that you could really respect Mr. P.W. Botha, because if he said something, you know, you knew that his the way it was going to be, and he wouldn't try and be manipulative like the other two. So it was pretty interesting. And even when he came over to South Africa, he came to a rugby match in one of our stadiums there. The crowds just roared when he arrived in the stadium. I mean, this is just one man from the country north of us, and I don't think they even gave our own politicians the same applause and excitement. I mean, he was just loved in Southern Africa. I mean, even the blacks in his own nation, you know, people would come up to him and want his signature and things, and it was just so funny because he had one bodyguard, and he used to drive around in the old, what we call a Peugeot. I don't know if you get a vehicle like that in America.
Peugeot, yes.
Yes, but one of his old Peugeots, he used to drive in one of these things with one bodyguard, and he was prime minister of the country. You know, so much for a country where everybody's supposed to hate the white prime minister. And now when you see Robert Mugabe, he's got two bulletproofed vehicles, you know, one driving in front of the other, so you don't know which one he's in, and he's got loads of people on motorbikes in front, armored vehicles behind with troops in, and they've already murdered people before who haven't got out the way quick enough when he's been coming down their main streets. So it's just quite a difference. You know, I have a lot of respect for Ian Smith.
All right, Neil, anything else you wanted to ask?
No, you're doing a great job, Dr. Stan, and thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, our guest this evening is Charles Van Vaken. Would you like to tell our listeners again how they can get a copy of your book, Shooting Back, and, of course, where they can, of course, get more information on frontline ministry? Because if you're out there in the listening audience, you know, I think this is a very important ministry. We personally support it, my wife and I, because we believe in Peter Hammond and what he's doing. And now, having had an opportunity to talk to Charles, we certainly believe he's got a good staff working with him. So how can people get in touch with your ministry, and how can they get copies of your book, Shooting Back?
www.frontline.org, O-R-G, .za. That will get you through to our website to let you know about the work that we're doing in Africa with Frontline Fellowship. We specialize in working in the war zones of Africa where the conventional missionary can't live with his family. And so Dr. Hammond and his staff have for many years been working with terrorists and freedom fighters and government troops around Africa, taking the gospel to them, discipling the nations, and it's been quite an experience. And then obviously with my church being attacked, I was drawn into that very much too. Normally, you know, one would go into their areas, but this came very close to home. And that's when I wrote the book Shooting Back, The Right and Duty of Self-Defense. It's actually available on Amazon.com too if people want to get hold of it quite easily. But they can phone a number to ITMI, which is our sister mission here in America in Tempe, Arizona. And their phone number is 888-918-4100. So that is 888-918-4100. If they'd like to get a copy of my book, they sell it for $10 plus shipping.
All right, fine. Well, of course, Peter has got some excellent books there, too.
That's right. He's got some really good books, too. Yeah,
and I think it's important, though. You realize, of course, you don't get any place by hating people who do things like this. And, of course, if you can really manifest Christian love to them, what a wonderful opportunity to change their lives.
That's right.
And, you know, I just think it's so wonderful you were willing to go and to talk to these people, the revolutionaries who would try to kill you and the people in your church. And I'm sure it had an impact on many of them, and I'm hoping that this man, the commander, this is the only way his life will ever change. And he'll begin to realize, of course, that he's been manipulated in this whole incredible scenario. And the tragedy is today in our schools, in our universities, in our colleges, our young people are being indoctrinated in these same ideas of hating America. And they can tell you everything wrong with America and very little right about America. And this is how they get to the minds of the blacks in Africa. This is how they get to the minds of the children in the United States. And if you've got your children in government schools or your grandchildren in government schools, you better think about getting them out, because they're after their heart, minds, and souls. And if you're not careful, they're going to get them. Well, how is the economy doing in South Africa at the present time?
Apparently, you know, we are told by our government officials that the economy is growing and everything's doing really well, which is pretty scary. You know, you always got to believe the opposite of what they tell you. But statistically, we've lost, as far as I know, it's over 500,000 jobs already since the new government took over. So
Is that since Mugabe took over? Is that since
South Africa? Yeah, so this is since Nelson Mandela took over.
Okay.
So since then, we've lost over 500,000 jobs in our country. So how the economy? I suppose the economy could be growing through inflation. You know, one doesn't know. But they reckon that everything's going well. But I mean, businesses are closing in our country, left, right, and center. People are starving. The unofficial rate of unemployment looks to be around about 50%.
50%.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, people don't. You know, if you look at any government stats and their information, that they'll never give you those kind of stats. But quite frankly, there's people are sitting around with nothing to do, and they starve. I don't want to say they're all starving, because there is quite a large underground what you call the black economy. You know, that's also working in South Africa, but you know, there's no control over the government, like it should be. There's little control the government can have over that.
Well, I remember when I lived in South Africa, the government subsidized the prices of bread and sugar and two or three other commodities,
mm-hmm.
so everybody could buy them, but they didn't have a price. You know, they subsidized to keep the price low so that people would always have bread and the other thing, the basic essentials of life. Are they still doing that?
I don't think they're doing that any longer. I'm not sure about that, but I do remember it being heavily subsidized. At the moment, you know, they're making our petrol or our gas price. The government's got a third of the price is government taxes on it. That 33% on that is government taxes. So, you know, if they're helping you on the one side, they're cutting down everything on the other. I mean, that's what your economy is basically running on is, you know, petrol and movement and people getting around and communication and that sort of thing. So, you know, as soon as the government interfere in your economy like that, you always end up with a real mess, which is exactly what you're sitting with in Africa.
Well, now what's happening with the AIDS epidemic? We hear lots of stories about the impact of AIDS in South Africa, and then, of course, in Rhodesia and in Zambia. But what about South Africa? What about this epidemic? Is this really decimating the population as we hear?
Yes, not at the moment. In Zimbabwe and Zambia, people are already dying, quickly, with regards to the HIV/AIDS pandemic that's happening. South Africa, I think it's more a matter of that we don't see, so much what's happening around us. Our hospitals and that, in comparison to what the rest of Africa has, is pretty good. We've already had, ministers, deputy ministers and that in our cabinet that have died, people, parliamentarians, one of the aides to the state president died, and, you know, people will never say it was because of HIV/AIDS, you know, but when people start dying of things like pneumonia, I mean, there's no reason why a government official with some of the best medication in the world should die because of pneumonia, then you know that there's something going on. So one can't really tell statistically what's happening with the deaths because of this whole idea of, you know, human rights with no human responsibility, where, you know, you can't tell if people have got, if they're HIV positive or not. But just one little story that might interest the listeners.
I think we're going to have to put that off to the next hour.
Okay,
we're going to
sure.
take our break here. And so we're going to have to, of course, say goodbye to our listeners up there in Washington, the state of Washington. Of course, we ask at this time to remember that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you agree that we have an important message that needs to be gotten out, we hope many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, because we're really dependent upon people who believe in what we're doing to be able to continue reaching out across America. For the news behind the news, the story behind the story. We ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, and of course to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Good evening again, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please, please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us from South Africa, from In Touch Ministries there. We have Charles Van Vaken. He's an Afrikaner. He's an African who is, of course, here visiting temporarily in the United States. He'll be going back over there. He works primarily in South Africa while Peter's off. Peter Hammett is off in the other countries. He has been into some of the other countries in Southern Africa representing In Touch Ministries. So let's just gradually look at some of the other countries. Of course, we hear talk about, you know, up to a quarter to a third of the population, the black population of South Africa, is HIV positive. When you get up into Zimbabwe and Zambia, what's happening there with the epidemic?
Okay, I've heard that in Zimbabwe, in areas like Victoria Falls town and areas like that, there's the percentage of the population HIV positive is 50%. And that I've heard from a doctor that's working in the area, so that's not government statistics. And then further up north, getting up into Zambia near Lake Tanganyika, an area called Mbala, I've got a missionary friend up there, and he was telling me that they were looking for blood to save the life of a little child, their little baby, and the nurses and doctors went through a whole class of children at a school and couldn't find a single kid HIV negative to be able to take blood from them. And his wife eventually gave blood to save the life of this little child.
Well, you know, the frightening thing is there's some new reports here in America that suggest that a lot of these children who are HIV positive, their mothers are HIV negative, which suggests, of course, they're being infected by the vaccines and other things that we're giving them. Of course, the World Health Organization is over there to help. At least that's what we're told. But the new information coming out has been from a gentleman named Gisselquist, who works for the Royal Society in London, has come out with these statistics. If this is true, what we're seeing is not an epidemic. What we're seeing is genocide. And, yeah. But then you have to understand there is evil in the world. And it's about time people begin to look into that, and that'll be covered in my, I hope, it'll be covered in my May newsletter, which is just about done now. We seem to be always behind, but soon one of these days we're going to get caught up on our newsletters. Anyway, you know, it sounds like this is just a terrible, terrible tragedy. We're talking about really total depopulation. We know that in certain of those countries, you know, countries like Botswana, Rhodesia, Zambia. I mean, the life average life has gone from about 68 years down to 33 years.
That's right. It's in the low 30s already. It's just unbelievable what's going on there. And pretty interestingly enough, the only country in Africa to turn around their rate of HIV infection is Uganda. And they've actually got a negative rate at the moment. And what's happening there was they started teaching abstinence. From the government, they're not teaching condom use anymore in the country, and it's just made a radical difference. Now our politicians go up there to go and see, you know, at our expense, you know, how things are done, and then they come back and they don't implement them. And you know, it's a matter of what hasn't worked anywhere else in the world. They seem to try to be implementing in South Africa. It's just totally brainless.
Well, of course, there's really a lot of pressure from the World Health Organization. We're not going to give you any money unless you, of course, use this failed public health policy. And unfortunately, I think many of the politicians would rather have the money than save the lives of the children and the adults in their area. Well, what's happening in Zambia now? There was a fellow named Salabia.
Chiluba? Yes.
What was his name?
President Chiluba.
Chiluba.
Yes, that's right.
All right,
yeah.
Fine. And, yeah. Of course, I understand he left, but was he able to bring any stability to Zambia?
Yes, see, interestingly enough, when Dr. Kenneth Kaunda was president for 27 years in Zambia. He managed to bankrupt the nation from being the richest country in Africa, with Britain having left them £8 billion when they left there, or pulled out of the country and handed over the reins to Kenneth Kaunda. He managed to make Zambia into a total basket case, and was also one of the most, it was actually Northern Rhodesia originally, and was a wonderful nation, also exporting goods and things, and ended up to be this basket case. And then after 27 years, there was pressure on Kaunda to abdicate and to hand over reins, so they had a general election. And interestingly enough, a Christian, President Chiluba, came to power, and he brought great stability to the nation. I mean, I remember going into the nation about a week after his election, and there wasn't a single restaurant in the capital city. I eventually bought a pizza from some place. It was the most disgraceful food that in South Africa we wouldn't even feed to our dogs. And, you know, that's the state of the nation. I mean, the roads were just potholed everywhere, and Chiluba managed to really pull things together. And then he unfortunately started to get a bit greedy, and he ended up really messing up things big time. He unfortunately, right in the beginning when he came to power, didn't understand the difference between church and state, and being a Christian, he forgave Kenneth Kaunda, the previous president's son, who had murdered his fiancée, let him off out of jail with a comment, you know, we Christians, we forgive. He didn't understand that God doesn't give the state the authority to forgive, but to be the ministers of justice, and that he could only forgive in his personal capacity, or maybe in his capacity as a member of the church. So that was one of the mistakes he first made, and then he started going very much downhill after he into his second term as president. And then he tried to change the constitution so that it would allow him a third term, and the reason for that, the people were saying, was because he's been so involved in corruption that if anybody else came to power, he would get into big trouble. And so eventually, you know, with the chaos and the build-up of the people being against him standing for a third term, eventually he did step down. But an appointee of his in the same political party actually took power from him. And there's been, you know, quite a bit of chaos. But the Zambian people are very laid-back kind of people. There's generally not much violence in the country or anything like that. And many of the tribes actually originally from the Zulu nation that is in South Africa, in KwaZulu-Natal. And many of them are people, their forefathers actually ran away from Shaka Zulu, who was, you know, probably rated as one of the greatest warriors that's ever, or greatest military thinkers that's ever been on earth. You know, these were his soldiers and that were scared and didn't want to be part of his military machine, and they ran up north. So the people in Zambia can actually communicate quite easily with the dialect that they have with our Zulu people in South Africa.
All right, fine. So Zambia then is certainly very, very rich in copper, and
that's
that was always a major export, but the copper price of copper has been kept down so low that it's pretty hard for the country to generate much in the way of funds. But anyway, it's a stable country, at least at the present time.
That's right. So it's Kenneth Kaunda, you know, his problem was that when he had come to power, he basically nationalized virtually everything. I mean, he nationalized the copper mine. So, I mean, even although copper might have not have been a very expensive metal, the fact is, with a nationalization, you know, you're just going nowhere with it fast. And he had gone to such an extent that when I had gone into the country for the first time, I'd found out that he had actually nationalized a place, a laundry, places where you go wash your clothes. You know, this is the kind of extent to which he had gone to nationalize things and to socialize the country. Just unbelievable. It was against the law for people to make trinkets and to make carvings with their hands and to sell it to people on the street. It was illegal. You know, he rather took grain and maize and that donated by the United Nations, and he would rather feed the people and himself. So by the time Chiluba came to power, you had a whole lazy nation that was expected to get all their food from the government. And that came to a sudden halt when Chiluba came to power, and his basic idea to the country was, if you don't work, you're not going to eat, you know. So it was a sudden change in the nation at that time.
All right, fine. Well, you know, Africa, really a wonderful, wonderful continent, rich, lots of natural resources, wonderful farmland, and other great tragedies, of course. Oh, when you harness a man's basic initiative, you can create a great deal, and man can be very productive. But when you have rules and regulations and controls, every time you pass a law, you take away a little freedom. Get enough laws, don't have any freedom left at all.
That's right. And that's very much ingrained in African thinking, too, native African thinking, that, you know, there's only a limited amount of resources in the world. And they, in their families, they would look after each other and, you know, some special friends. And if you want to think of it in a different way, you know, there's that little circles of groups of people, of friends and family, very close friends. And if you're outside of this little group, you are basically a competitor for those limited resources. You know, whereas we as Christians don't believe in there just being these limited resources. You know, there's we can take a field and start using it for production. Whereas in their terms of thinking, you know, if you've got a field, you can eat the berries on it, and then maybe next year you might get some more berries. But, you know, let's face it, America, you know, was the land where the people were dying before your pilgrims came, and now you feed 300 million people plus the rest of the world, you know. So we believe in developing things, using resources God has given us, and developing it. Whereas that kind of thinking doesn't really apply in the African mind. Africa hasn't had 300 years of reformation and Christian thinking.
Well, hopefully, of course, the church will have an impact. What's happening to the church overall in South Africa and in the other countries? Is there revival there? Are people beginning to turn to the Lord?
Yes, it's unbelievable. I was actually just discussing this with my wife a few weeks ago, and I was just saying that, you know, so many people are coming to the Lord in Africa, and especially in South Africa. It's just unbelievable. But the more we're seeing the population turn to God, the more godless our governments seem to be coming in Africa. And I think that's a reflection of the limitations that we give on the gospel that we're teaching to people. We're not teaching a comprehensive gospel that applies to all areas of life, that can impact our economy, impact business, impact science and history and the way we see the world and all this sort of thing. You know, we're limiting just to salvation. And instead of making disciples, we're just making converts, which is very disconcerting. So I believe we have a major task in Africa of discipling the nations, and that's exactly what Frontline Fellowship is all about, is to go out and disciple these people so that the gospel can impact every area of their lives. And rather than just making converts, you know, let's make disciples out of the people of Africa. We've seen just before I even came here, I've got a friend that's running a black pastor in a township, and they've just seen the Lord doing great work amongst them. There were 20 corpses in their small little township last year. People had been murdered. One lady had been knifed to death with a little baby still alive, just lying on her corpse. The most horrendous stories and just terrible things that were going on in the township. And by the grace of God, through their prayer meetings, praying every single day at 12 o'clock and once a month running prayer meetings from 10 at night till 4 in the morning and things, since the beginning of January this year, there hasn't been a single corpse in their, or a single murder in their township. Great work, people getting saved at this little church, just absolutely incredible things that are happening. Another woman that was involved in witchcraft and ancestral worship got saved in another township with another church that I work with, and another 19 people also got saved there. So the Lord is really working in Africa, unbelievably. And amongst the Zulu Nation, too, there's a mission base called the KwaZulu-Bantu Mission Station in KwaZulu-Natal, where many people have come to salvation. It's just incredible to see the work the Lord's doing there. They have a private Christian school on this mission station, which is, you know, 99% black Zulu children. They've produced the top science student in South Africa in the education system without a science laboratory. The school didn't even have a science laboratory. It's just incredible the work that's been going on there. Great results. Children work exceptionally hard. But they don't take any nonsense. The Zulu Nation is an extremely disciplined people. I mean, you can sit through a 2 or 3 hour service and you won't hear a little sound from the children, you know, not like us in the West who have our kids breaking the church down and pulling down the curtains and things, you know. It's just unbelievable. It's quite an experience to get through to that mission station.
Well, the Zulus are, you know, really a remarkable people. I know if I was ever going to go to war, I'd certainly want to have the Zulus on my side.
That's for sure, that's for sure. In fact, when the German missionaries came to work amongst the Zulu people said to them, you know, your standard of living, your morals are so low. What on earth do you think you're coming to do here? What can you teach us? So they're an incredible people. And funny enough, even at the school and at the mission station, the liberal press have been going crazy because the elderly ladies in the community are still checking up on their grandchildren and their daughter's virginity. And obviously this has now been blamed on the German missionaries in the area, and they're saying, no, this is Zulu tradition. You know, they're watching over these kids so they don't get HIV/AIDS and that they're not sleeping around and that sort of thing. And this is their high moral standards, and they're still doing it. And, you know, we're not going to interfere with them. So it's pretty interesting. And then the liberal press got, started saying horrible things about the school that was at the mission, and that the teachers were burning the feet of the children to discipline them. Oh, absolute nonsense. And then all of a sudden, the school had this major influx of applications by the Zulu people to get their kids into this private Christian school on the mission. And one of the German missionaries asked a local, and he said, you know, I don't understand this. We're getting all this bad press, and now we have this massive application of forms just coming in all the time. So this man said to him, no, he says, the people in the community are saying that if the press don't like you people, then you must be doing something very good at this mission school.
Well, I can certainly sympathize with that. But, you know, one of the worst things that ever happened to Africa was the advent of television. When we went to Africa, and it was in 1974, and television hadn't come in yet. And, of course, the entertainment was the radio programs where they would tell stories. They would read these various adventure stories. And each evening, where they'd read a chapter of this adventure story. And I remember there was a fellow named Hammond, as I remember, who had written some of these, not Peter Hammond, but somebody else. They were most wonderful stories. But radio, you have to use your mind. You have to use your imagination. With television, of course, they simply program you. And I began, when television came in, when we were there, you began to see the whole attitude of people changing. Mm. Instead of wanting to sit around and talk in the evening and share ideas, everybody was going to watch television.
That's right.
And
yeah.
I really think that the ideas that were programmed into the minds of the African people, both black and white, were totally disastrous as far as the stability of the nation was concerned.
Yes, our television in South Africa is a total disaster. In fact, I had a missionary friend that was working in our country, and when she arrived in South Africa in early 1990s, she said that the television that was pretty decent. I mean, there's not anything that was too bad on it or anything. And by the time she left the country about 6 or 7 years later, she said it was so bad that it was worse than anything she'd ever seen in America. And she was a young American lady that was working with us. And there's just been a total turnaround. Our government has gone to the extent of, in 1996, they even legalized child pornography in our country. And the police statistics show almost 400% in child abuse in 1 year after that. They've just gone crazy. You know, it's got to a stage now where we all live behind metal bars. In my home, I have big bars bolted into brickwork outside every window. I have security gates on every door. And now we have, you know, the innocent law-abiding citizen living in jails in the country, and the bad guys all out on the street. And somebody was just saying that they read an internet report on South Africa today where people are just closing off their suburban areas and putting gates up across the roads and putting armed guards at the gates. And that's exactly what's happening, even against the law. People just say to the government, you just stay out of our face and we'll look after ourselves. And they're just closing off their own areas, their own suburban areas, closing off their streets, public roads, and they're putting booms up across the streets that nobody can get in, and they're putting armed guards in the area to protect them. And that's the way people are living up in Johannesburg and Pretoria and these areas now.
Well, I can remember in Bloemfontein, in the neighborhood where we lived, You know, you could go walking at 11 o'clock at night. You just had no thought or even of concern about it. You know, there was just no thought anybody was going to hurt
you.
That's
right. Even in the black townships, right. You could walk around 9, 10 o'clock at night. I've got a young girl that lives in Khayelitsha near Cape Town. And she said, before we could walk around all hours of the night and that in our township. She says, now I have to go into my little house, my little hut that she's got there. And she says, I lock myself up at 7 o'clock and I don't go out until the sun has risen the next morning.
Isn't it wonderful that we have freedom now? That's right.
Yes, that's the kind of freedom that we've got in South Africa
but
now.
Do a lot of the blacks there realize, of course, that they've been sold a bill of goods and that, you know, you have to get some sort of a stability and certainly get away from this Marxist system? You have to have leaders who really believe, you know, in principles rather than in power. Any of the whites feel maybe they were better off under the apartheid system that was improving rather than the way it's going today?
Yeah, it's quite strange because I read a report in a very liberal newspaper in Cape Town, which is quite strange because they helped put the African National Congress into power, and they were saying how conditions were so much better during apartheid, which is very strange, you know. It's like, you put the guys into power, you know, what are you complaining about? But anyway, that's what they're saying now. And I mean, the people themselves also realize, you know, that the place is in a mess. But the problem is that during the apartheid era, the ANC had a lot of money, and they used to help people, you know, and that's exactly what people wanted. They wanted servant leaders. The only problem was that when these servant leaders became the government, you know, everything changed. And now they don't have servant leaders anymore. Now, you know, they're just told how things will run and they have to do what they're told. But these people would help them with, you know, legal aid and things like that because, you know, Nelson Mandela would come over to the West and he'd just get showered with dollars and pounds and all sorts of things. So they could help people that had financial problems or needed legal aid or anything like that. So these people basically voted in servant leaders, which you know, became tyrants at the end of the day. So I think the people have an understanding that things aren't, you know, they have a great understanding that things aren't the way they should be, but they also see these people as, you know, they trust them because of the history that the ANC has got. And the ANC started off as a really good, you know, grassroots movement that wanted to work along with the old government many years ago, you know, 40-something years ago. And then it was taken over by the Marxists, and that's when things started going to pieces. So the people, they understand that things aren't the way they should be in the country, and they feel it because they're just losing their jobs and they don't have any work and they're struggling to put food on the table. But one pastor, black pastor, said to me, the reason these guys will stay in power is because the black population believe that these guys, anything that they introduce or any laws they pass in South Africa, because of their history, it must be for their good. So they wouldn't question stuff that happened just because of the history of their leaders, and they trust them. And I just laughed at it because I said that's exactly where the whites were previously in South Africa. You know, put all their trust in the old National Party that was looking after them, who also, you know, reneged on all their promises and protections that they put in place.
Were you acquainted with it when I was there? I was aware of the fact there was a secret society in South Africa called the Bundesbond.
Yes.
And, of course, if you wanted to get ahead, you had to be a member of the Bundesbond. And, of course, I remember at the university when I was teaching, they picked a very young man. He was a nice man, but he had a little experience to become the chief of surgery. But it was basically because he was a member of the secret society. And this seemed to be how you got ahead in South Africa. You were a member of the Bundesbond. Is that still there?
Yes, apparently they still exist, but they're not very powerful at the moment. They don't really play a part. I mean, people have said that they've, disintegrated and what have you, but one never knows. I mean, the Azanian People's Liberation Army, APLA, that attacked our church, they're supposed to also not exist anymore. But, I mean, you go into the townships and, you know, I've been witnessing in the township, somebody came up to me and said, I'm a soldier, and I said, you know, what army are you in? Are you in APLA? And he said to me, yes. You know, now this is what's happening on grassroots on the ground, you know, but in the press and everywhere else they're saying that, the guys have given up their weapons and they don't exist anymore. So one doesn't really know if the Bundesbond is there or not, because obviously I've never been involved with this sort of thing. But some interesting theories that have been put forward in South Africa, and that was that the Bruder Bond actually allowed the African National Congress to come and take over, and one of the reasons for it was the whole HIV/AIDS story that's been going on, and they knew that with the pressure from the outside world for them being white supremacists in Africa, let's call it that, they would have to have paid for you know, for all the HIV/AIDS cases in the country and would have had to support it financially. Whereas with the ANC in power, they couldn't care two hoots about the people that are dying. I mean, people might have heard already about our president who doesn't believe that HIV causes AIDS and all kinds of strange ideas that are coming up from the government. And the courts have even ruled that the government should be giving intraviral drugs to our people to stop the spread of AIDS, and the government's just refusing to do it. Even with money that's been given by America and other Western nations for this. So it's very strange. You know, one doesn't really know what's happening behind the scenes in the political arena.
Well, I will tell you one thing, and that is Mabiki, of course, had lived in Great Britain for many years before he came to power. You know, and supposedly he's here to represent the Africans. He was living in England, of course. He's part of Gorbachev's State of the World Forum, and his name was on their list of you know, they had maybe 10 people on the board of directors of the Gorbachev Foundation. There's Mabiki. And, of course, the whole thrust of the Gorbachev Foundation is population control and really an elitist concept. So I did not feel very comfortable when I saw him becoming the president of South Africa, certainly replacing Nelson Mandela. And the fact that he did everything he could to stop doing anything really to stop the spread of AIDS, or to treat these tragic people. You know, his own people were dying. And of course, he did everything he could to avoid treating them. And you have to ask yourself why. Even going to the, you know, to the extent of trying to keep the disease from being passed to mother to child. You know, and when we can, you know, almost completely stop neonatal transmission of HIV disease from an infected mother to her infected child, and Mabiki opposed that. Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling in here. Hi, Mike. Do you have a question or comment?
Two questions, Stan. You mentioned the Bruder Bond.
Bruder Bond, yes.
I wonder who that is. That obviously the first half of that word, Bruder, is a brotherhood.
Right, a brother bond. It was a secret Afrikaans society that was formed after the Boer War. It goes all the way back there, and the whole idea was the secret society one day would take over control of South Africa, take it away from the British. And so from the time of the end of the Boer War in 1902 until I think it was about, 1948 when the Nationalist Party came to power?
Mm-hmm, that's right, National Party came to power then, that's right.
And, of course, there are secret societies in every country, and South Africa was the Bruder Bond. Okay, anything
that's
else?
That's B-R-U-D-E-R-V-O-N-D.
B-O-N-D, Bruder Bond.
V.
Let's get our guest. Charles, how would you spell it?
Okay, it's B-R-O-E-D-E-R-B-O-N-D. Bruder Bond.
Right, it's two separate words, Bruder Bond.
Yeah. No, it's one word.
Oh, it is one word?
Yes,
okay,
that's
fine.
Right.
All right,
yeah.
Fine.
Yeah.
All right, anything else, Mike?
Yeah. Thank you so much for having Charles on tonight. He's a wonderful person to listen to, and his work is most remarkable, especially regarding his witness for Christ.
Right. Well, of course, that's why I had him on, and I was really just so pleased that he was available for us.
Mm-hmm. And, to a more earthly topic, the economic, in the last hour, there was more talk of the economic takeover of farms and businesses. I can't help but think that the way this happens is so similar to the way the mafia works, and which is, first of all, to get somebody to become economically dependent, and then economically dependent.
All right, Mike, you're going to have to hold your thought there because we're going to have to go to the half-hour break, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Charles Van Dijk, and our telephone number, if you'd like to call up, is 1- 888 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we have, of course, Mike with us. And he is pointing out that sort of the way that the things are operated, sort of like the mafia, you first of all get people dependent on you, and then, of course, you own them. Is that basically what you're saying, Mike?
I misspoke a little bit. The second part would be economically indebted. And then they find ways of bankrupting the person who is indebted, and then there's a takeover. And, of course, that occurs in large scale here in the States, all over the place. But on the big scale, we have the UN giving loans to governments, businesses, and even the people out in the hinterlands. Even we hear reports of them making $10 loans to women who want to... Now, $10 would be a large amount of money to them, but they're starting to have some small business and they want to get going with it. And then, before long, they realize that they're... they can't sell whatever their goods are. And then their whole family becomes indebted and then taken over by the UN.
Well, certainly this is happening in countries all throughout Africa, and I know there is a program supposedly to loan money to women to start their businesses. But, of course, the biggest problem has been that the World Bank and IMF have been loaning money to these various countries, and then, of course, usually what happens is the dictator runs off with the money, and then, of course, when he leaves, why, he leaves the people there indebted. And, of course, all the money they pay in taxes, or most of it, doesn't go to build up their infrastructure. It goes to pay interest on the loans. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, it's not just their money they run off with. It's all their property, because that is what they use for collateral, or in some way they have ways of just absolutely taking over families, farms, countrysides, and governments.
Let's get Charles opinion on what you're saying. Charles, did you hear what Mike was saying?
Yes, thanks, Mike. Thank you very much for the encouragement. Just a comment on this whole business of being, let's talk about it in a micro level first. And that is, in terms of African thought and African, the way that they work in their communities with each other, we in the West are very much into this idea of being independent from each other. That is not so amongst the black population. They are very dependent on each other, excluding government interference. I'm talking on the micro level, families, individuals, that sort of thing. If I wanted to do business with a black community in South Africa, if I wanted to meet with somebody there, straight away what I would do is I would need to give a gift to the person that I'm going to be dealing with. Now, in your area, this would, you know, in our Western thinking, this would be corruption. You know, this is, I'm making a payment to this person to try and get business out of him. Not so in their community. To them, this would be a matter of me now building a relationship with them. That man that I give the gift to means I want to become his friend. And he then is indebted to me. And he might not give me a gift, but he might introduce me to somebody who could help me with a business that I'm wanting to establish. Once he's introduced me to this person, then I'm re-indebted to him again. And that is the way these people do business and the way they work with each other. So you might be seeing this thing just on a large, on a macro scale, but it's just the working out of personal ideas and the way they work with each other in their communities. So, yes, it's not a biblical principle, and it brings people into slavery, and that's exactly why Africa looks the way it does today. It's because of these sorts of ideas, which haven't been changed by the gospel of Christ, where, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, you can't be dependent on other people, but I mean, basically at the end of the day, this is just, buying each other, off to be able to do business with each other. And to them, it's building relationships. So, you know, we've got totally different worldviews. And, you know, you are seeing it on a macro level. You know, we can obviously in South Africa see it on a micro level, but basically it's just a working out, of, you know, many small micro levels work out into the macro level.
And, well, what I see is the UN and the World Bank and the IMF working together for economic...
That's right.
...ultimate control of the globe.
That's right. And, I mean, they're the ones that are feeding the people of Africa after, you know, the man-made famines that are going on. And
They call it feeding.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, you know, when they tell these people what to do, you know, who are the people going to listen to? You know, the church that hasn't been feeding them or the UN that has been feeding them? You know, this is the kind of problems we're having out there right now.
Of course, what Peter Hammond is doing, is actually trying to at least provide for the earthly or the worldly needs of the people, as well as then trying to provide for their spiritual needs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. That's exactly what we're doing as an organization is, you know, we're getting onto the ground, and, you know, people do donate money to our organization. It is getting onto the ground in these places, whereas, you know, when things are happening via governments, just to give an example, you people gave money to KwaZulu-Natal, which is one of our provinces, a provincial government, to curb the spread of HIV/AIDS in the area, and the central government took it away from them and said, no, we'll take this from you, and we will distribute it where we think necessary. It's not up to the Americans to give it to you people. This is the kind of thing that happens amongst our people. If you're wanting your money to get onto the ground in Africa and to change lives, then you need to do it through organizations that are, you know, credible, and definitely not through our government sources.
All right, anything else, Mike?
That's all, thank you.
Okay, thanks so much. And that was Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Our telephone number, 464-8295, or here in the Central Coast of California, I should say out across America, would be 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest this evening is Charles Van Vaken, and we're talking about, of course, what's going on in Africa. And I think the thing that I learned when I was there is that it's an entirely different worldview. I mean, you have 8 major tribes in Africa, and, of course, you have sub-tribes, and you have the Sutu people, and you have the North Sutu and the South Sutu,
right.
And everybody hates everybody else.
Yeah.
I mean,
and right.
This is really what it was all about.
Yeah.
And, of course, they would be all killing one another if it weren't for, some sort of a central bank or central authority. And, of course... underlying everything is the witch doctor, the occult. And, of course, when I was there, why people would usually go, even the Christians would go to the witch doctor before they'd go to the white doctor.
Hmm.
And it was just, all the maids, we had a black maid, and she was a Christian, nominal Christian, and of course she had her bed up on paint cans. All the maids had their beds up on paint cans. Why would they put their beds up on paint cans? That was to keep Togolosh from getting into bed with them.
That's
who was Togolosh? Well, why don't you tell our listeners who Togolosh was?
Togolosh is supposedly a little spirit type man that would supposedly hurt them at night if they'd been, but he's very small, and you know, they were actually quite scared of the fact of this little thing coming and getting into their beds and causing the havoc for them. So they would put their beds on bricks or on paint cans or something like that. And, you know, it's just quite unbelievable because a friend of mine who was studying anthropology, he was telling me how that when there's lots of pressure from all over the world and everything about on our gold mines because, you know, the gold miners weren't being looked after properly, and they were coming from all over Africa, and they had really bad sleeping conditions and all that. Well, anyway, the gold mines went and built brand new, beautiful buildings for all the miners, and the miners wouldn't move in. They refused point blank to move into these new buildings. And eventually the gold mines had to get a professor in anthropology to come in and work amongst the people to see what the problem was, because the black men knew that white people think this is a big joke about the Togolosh. So they don't talk about this generally to you because they know you're going to think it's a big joke. And at the end of the day, the professor said to them, they got to raise the beds. They got to make the beds much higher off the ground in these places, and the guys will move in. And they did it, and they moved in immediately into these brand new buildings. So, you know, that's the extent to which people believe in this little mysterious Togolosh, you know, and then what evil and trouble he can cause for them.
And of course, this is these spiritual beliefs permeate every aspect of Africa today, and of course permeate all the tribes and all the people. And of course, Charles is from Cape Town, but we lived 600 miles away in Bloemfontein. Maybe it was longer. Maybe it was, what, 1,200 miles? I've forgotten. How far is it from Cape Town up to Bloemfontein?
It's about 1,000 kilometers. So, yes, it's probably about 650 right. to 700 miles, yeah.
Right. But, you know, these ideas permeate everything. Well, we've got Barbara calling in. This is my wife, who was with me in South Africa. Barbara, do you have a question or comment?
A little bit of both. I am just so enjoying this program with Minnie Van Dyck, to hear him, you know, and what he is doing in South Africa today. But, you know, I hear all of the terrible things that are going on in South Africa today. And if you just bear with me for a minute to tell you what it was like when we were there 30 years ago, it was not like this. We did not know fear. It was one of the places where you could walk, as my husband said, at night at 11 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
There was no fear. You could walk into the black section of town. There was no fear. You could go into the Bantu stands, as I did frequently, and there was no fear.
Mm-hmm.
The people there were wonderful. They were friendly, the black and the white. And there, you know, there was a wonderful camaraderie. It's difficult to explain, and I'm sure you have lived there all of your life, and you must have experienced it. It is not like it is today. I know what you're saying today is true, because I have spoken with many people who have families there, and they talk about the violence, that there is not a block in a city in Natal, you know, in the Transvaal, where there is not violence, has not touched the people there. It was not so,
yes.
You know, during the time we lived there.
That's right. It's unbelievable how things have changed. We have about 20,000 murders in South Africa a year right now, and we have a population of less than 50 million people, which makes us about 600% more than you have in the United States of America. And we're basically the murder capital of the world. It's just unbelievable the Bible is very clear that when people don't get punished, then, you know, or they should be punished, and if they are punished, then they will hear and fear and do no more presumptuously. But if you don't have a justice system, and, you know, so many of the police force are involved in corruption and things, you know, this is the way the country goes very quickly. And lots of it is political rhetoric and racism that is enforced upon the population by the politicians, because they think they're going to be losing power if they don't keep this hatred of racism alive in the communities. Mm-hmm. So it's really scary. I mean, the black people are suffering far more in the townships than I even as a white person suffer in South Africa. I mean, for them it is far, far worse than it was ever under apartheid.
Anything else, Barbara?
Well, one of the things, yeah, the radio program was The World of Hammond Innes.
The World of Hammond Innes. Okay, right. I knew there was a Hammond Innes.
Okay, that's great.
Well, it was on there.
I don't remember which, but Hammond Innes was a British writer, and he had the most wonderful, wonderful adventure stories. We never really got them here in the United States. We get them in Great Britain and in South Africa, and he was this, really a crafted, wonderful, wonderful stories, and every evening you'd listen to the radio, and they'd have another chapter.
Yeah.
From
15 minutes a night, and you hung on every word to the next night it was coming. But I just want to say one thing, that I remember my time there as probably one of the best periods of my life.
Yeah.
When I lived there at that time, and the people truly taught me what it meant to love your neighbor as yourself.
Yes.
I have never met people who were so friendly, who were so loving, who were so caring.
Yes, as across
people.
The races.
I have never experienced it anywhere in the world, and it is probably one of the greatest losses that, you know, it does not exist anymore.
You know, even when I go into townships now and I go teach youth Bible studies for youth, or I run an introduction to a biblical worldview seminar or something like that in the black townships, the people there are just so warm and welcoming, and, you know, they'll say to me, you know, when are you coming back again? I'll say, well, look, I'm going to America. I've got to go to Port Elizabeth. I'm running seminars here and there and what have you. And they say, we don't care where you're going. You just make sure you come back soon.
You do all this then too, for the Intets ministry. Is that a ministry to the African?
Yes. It's Frontline Fellowship is the name of our organization. Our sister mission is here in America called In Touch Missions International, and we basically work together in Africa and also in Eastern Europe and places like that where we disciple the nations. So, but you know, I just want to also comment on. Just to thank you, Dr. Stan and Barbara, for coming over. You know, we really depend on people from the West coming to even do research in our country, just to get the truth known, you know, rather than all these government statistics and nonsense that they produce, and just coming to help and serve our people. Another friend of mine, too, she came and studied over in America, and somebody paid for her to study speech therapy. She got her doctorate, and the condition was that she goes back to Africa and works there until she's on pension, just to give back, to pay back for the studies would be that she must come back to South Africa, and she's done that, and she's now just gone on a retirement this year. And we're just really thankful for people that are willing to come, you know, even into difficult and leave their own culture and their own homes and that, and come and serve in our country and across Africa, because, we'd be far worse off if you people didn't help us.
Well, Chris, I feel that right now, of course, as America goes, so goes the world. So this is why I'm staying here, and we'll be here as long as we can, trying to make people really understand that behind all of these things that are going on today is a great spiritual battle. And this, of course, is what the church is missing. I mean, they look upon what's happening as political. No, it's not a political battle. It's not a cultural battle. It's not an ideological battle. It's a spiritual battle that's being fought. And people don't understand that there really is evil in the world. There really are secret societies. There really are organizations out there that have a different worldview.
Yes.
And of course, tragically, so many of our young people are getting taken in by this without, and even in your country, the blacks are being taken in by this and being mobilized to fight for their own destruction. They don't even realize it.
Yes, I was just speaking to somebody just the other day here in Colorado Springs, and I was saying to him that, when it comes to things like situational ethics, you know, you people discuss these issues and you can debate it in America. Our people are physically living it out. In other words, you know, if a situation is that can help me to murder 11 innocent people sitting in a church, well, then that must make it right, because that's what's right for me and that's what's right for the revolution, and that's what my Marxist teaching is all about. And we have to put up with this sort of thing all the time. Atheism, the whole idea that there isn't a God, so where do my rights come from? They come from the government, obviously. The government gave me my rights, you can also take them away again. And that's exactly what happens in Africa. Letlap and Bechlele, the commander that gave go-ahead for the St. James Massacre, he is an atheist and he believes that man is inherently good. He was complaining to me when we had lunch one day and we were busy discussing politics, discussing our spirit, talking about the gospel and the change that Christ that made in my life. And we're talking about these things, and he told me that people were giving money to support his soldiers that were locked up in jail for their terrorism in South Africa, giving money for them so that they could be educated to study. And while this money would be infiltrating through the political party to get through to the man sitting in the jail, it would be stolen. And he was really upset about this. And I said to him, Letlapa, I would have been surprised if the money got to the man. I believe it. We're all inherently wicked. So yeah, I am a Christian who's, defended innocent people. I believe everybody's inherently wicked. He's a murderer who's murdered or caused to have murdered many people in South Africa, and he believes people are inherently good because, that's his worldview. But the point is, at the end of the day, the Africans are actually physically working this out. Whereas, in your country at this time, it's still a debate, when the people physically start working out the atheism and the situational ethics, it's going to be another story.
Well, of course, here in America, our whole concept was built upon our Declaration of Independence that said that our freedom came from God. I mean, that was the only source of freedom. And of course, freedom was not the ability to do what you wanted to do. It was the ability to do what you should do according to God's rules. And for, you know, 150 years, these were the ideas upon which our society rested. Now, we've pretty well abandoned those. The Supreme Court, under the influence of the Masons, actually took God and prayer out of our schools and is gradually eroding and destroying this belief. In fact, today we don't even teach our children the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, is the birth certificate of our country. But, you know, it would be wonderful if all the people in the world could understand where freedom comes from. It doesn't come from government. It doesn't come from Karl Marx. It comes from God. And if people would follow that teaching, why, it would be a much better world. But, of course, then, of course, they have to realize they're answerable to God, and you can't go around killing other people because this is a violation of God's commandments. And, of course, the rules are already laid out. They're not my rules or your rules. They're God's rules.
That's right.
Man lived by God's rules, wouldn't it be a much better world?
Yes, and, you know, the whole idea of your forefathers having, or your founding fathers having, you know, been such a Christianized people, or people that were Christians, they had a great understanding of basing your constitution and the ideas in the socio-political arena on God's word. Now, in South Africa, we have the most liberal constitution in the world. You know, we have gay rights enshrined in our constitution. We have the right to abortion in our constitution, and I'm not talking about under the right to privacy. It is a constitutional right for a woman to murder a baby. You know, the most crazy things in the constitution. We even got one section in the constitution where you're guilty until proven innocent in a court of law, if you're dealing with an issue of affirmative action. Just totally, totally brainless ideas that are put there. And when Dr. Peter Hammond and a group of Christians had a meeting with Dr. Nelson Mandela when he was president, he had asked them to come and see him after a large march to Parliament on some issues with regards to our government. They were just saying to him how bad this constitution is. And Mr. Mandela said to them, it doesn't matter what's written in the constitution, because most people in South Africa can't read anyway. What makes the difference is what they see us do. That was from the mouth of Mr. Nelson Mandela.
Well, of course, the problem is that abortion is wrong, not because I think it's wrong, but because God says
that's
it's wrong.
That's right.
And, of course, homosexuality is wrong because God says it's wrong. And,
that's right.
You know, we're never going to have a perfect society unless, of course, all men are perfect, but at least the function of government should not be to authorize a violation of God's law. And my fear for your country as well as mine is that God is going to bring his vengeance on both societies because not only have the good people allowed it, but the church has allowed it.
Yes.
And this is my concern, is that the church is not speaking out as it should. And, of course, I believe that the church is to be the conscience of the society, and certainly that is not true in my country. I don't know what's happening in yours, but certainly the reason we're in the trouble we are today is because of the failure of our church and our ministers.
Yes, well, that we have the same problem. You know, the gospel that's being preached in South Africa is a very superficial gospel, and it's not extended to all areas of life. And just, you know, in dealing with that issue, I was speaking to a chap who, you know, somehow also called himself a Christian at a meeting one day, and we were talking about, you know, Christian biblical ethics in the political arena, and we were talking about, and I said to him, well, you know, the Christians have the best way, the only way, you know, because God has ordained certain things, and we have, you know, we believe, not in situational ethics, but we believe that there are standards that God has set. And I said to him, well, let's look at the idea of theft, you know. So he said to me, oh, no, theft is a universal ethic. Everybody believes theft is wrong. And eventually I said to him, no, but that's not the case. Robert Mugabe doesn't think theft is wrong. It's wrong if you're stealing from him, but if he wants to steal your farm, then it's not, then there's no problem with it. And that's the whole idea. You know, these are basic elementary ideas from the Ten Commandments. And, you know, people from different worldviews disagree on these issues. So, you know, how could you ever run a country when the president, you know, doesn't think that what he's doing is stealing when he's taking farmlands away from people? And that's, you know, straight back to the Marxist ideas again. You know, whatever the government does for the cause is has to be right. It doesn't matter if it's theft or if it's murder or anything else.
Well, I think the great problem we have today is that people have lost the vision of really of what America was all about. And, you know, I was so impressed when I was over living and working in South Africa. And, you know, what impressed me is I had a number of young men who were, we call them registrars. They were like residents here in the American hospital system. They were studying. They had graduated from medical school, taking an internship, and they were learning the trade of orthopedics. And I was in charge. I think we had 06 or 8 residents there who worked with me. And, of course, you know, they would never sit down, none of them would ever sit down at the table to have a lunch without saying a prayer first. And God seemed to be so very important in their lives.
Mm. That is very much the case in South Africa. The country still, even on the latest statistics, 75% of our population believe that they are Christian and that they all belong to some kind of, you know, Christian denomination in the country. So on the ground, our people, you know, have quite an awe of God, and they're very open to the gospel. Even the terrorists that I spoke to are open to the gospel. So it's pretty interesting because people here in America tell me very differently. You know, I said lots of people apparently think they're Christians, but they actually violently oppose the gospel often. Whereas you don't find that in Africa. You know, people are really open to it. But then, you know, every system they've tried, all the socialism and Marxism and, you know, ancestral worship, animism, all these sorts of things, just nothing has worked there for them. And, at the end of the day, the countries in the West who have been Protestant nations, who have worshipped God and have a godly standard of ethics and morality in the nation, they're the nations that are living the best lives, where people have the greatest freedom and can worship God freely and get on with their lives and get involved with business and look after their families and provide for them as God has told us to in the scriptures.
Well, it's a hope that we can get back to those fundamental values here in my country, because as I said, as America goes, so goes the world, because America really is the key. It's the most powerful, the wealthiest nation in the world.
That's right.
But, of course, if we do not return to God, if we don't see revival here, why, of course, if America falls, why, of course, I believe there'll be chaos throughout the world. Let's get your website out just one more time and the name of your book, so if people would like to get it, they can.
Okay. The organization's name is Frontline Fellowship, and it's www.frontline.org.za. And the telephone number, if anybody would like to buy the book Shooting Back that I wrote with regards to the St. James Massacre, that is 888-918-4100. That's here in Arizona. And that's our sister mission, ITMI, In Touch Mission International. And we'd love to hear from people if they'd like to get a couple of our, if they're not on the Internet and they'd like to get some of our older newsletters and things that we've sent out, or they can also read them on the Internet. They're most welcome to phone that number, and we can post some to them if they don't have access to the Internet. We'd love to hear from them.
All right, fine. Well, we're looking forward to, I think you're going to be on with us tomorrow or the next day. I can't remember which. Anyway,
that's right, tomorrow.
Thank you. It's been a fascinating, fascinating evening. I really enjoyed it, and I think our listeners have as well. Good night, and we'll be talking to you again.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Stan. Keep up the great work. If you people stay free, you give us hope for in the rest of the countries in Africa still. Thank you so much, and God bless you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you've enjoyed the evening. Charles was willing to come on for 2 hours with us. Pray for America. Pray for revival. And please remember to pray for our ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.